Hey, the mic's on. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your news dissector here at the Progressive Radio Network, .com. We have a phone number to call if you want to join this conversation, 888-874-4888. That number again, 888-874-4888. That's a lot of eights. But if you call us, you can talk to us. Joining me here in the studio, Kat Waters. She'll be introducing our first guest in a minute. We're talking about people's advocates today. We have the people's lawyer with us, Carl Meyer. You'll meet him in a minute. We have the people's bishop joining us in a few minutes. The man who's been arrested several times at Occupy, George Packard, a former Episcopal bishop. We also have some other business to conduct here on the program, so we're really excited that you're with us. Feel free to call in. We're here every week at this time on PRN-FM. Now, just one announcement coming up this weekend, an event that you might want to check out, something it's called the Russell Tribunal, and it's happening at Cooper Union. And what it is a discussion of the issues and rights of Palestinian people. And it's interesting to me because among the people speaking at this particular event, none other than Bishop Tutu of South Africa, the writer Alice Walker, is going to be at the closing section. Also, Ronnie Kasrils, former Minister of Intelligence from South Africa, an old friend of mine, will be participating as well. He'll be in New York back in a few weeks. I'm hoping we can get him on our program. So do check this out. As it turns out, when I was but a youth in graduate school, Kat, back in the day, so to speak, I was in London at the London School of Economics and was really invited to report on the Bertrand Russell Tribunal on Vietnam. This took place in Sweden, and it was about war crimes. It was the first discussion of war crimes. Among the people sitting on the panel was Jean-Paul Sartre, the famous existentialist, Simone de Beauvoir, and other luminaries on the left who at the time came under a lot of fire for taking this position and allowing the Vietnamese to testify. A lot of what they said then has been corroborated since, but in that period it was a very daring effort to actually bring the voice of the quote enemy to the West and to hear what the Vietnamese had to say about the war that was at that time really pounding their country and killing their people. So now, fast forward all these years, the Russell Tribunal is back in a new form, and it's been having hearings all over the world, and it's having one in New York this weekend. It'll be a chance to meet some luminaries, some very important people who know a lot about this issue, to take part in the discussion, take part in the debate about it as well. That's this weekend. Now, Kat, before we go to our first guest and your sterling introduction, which I'm sure you've been rehearsing all week, I want to start off, as we do on our program, with some music. And as I've mentioned several times, I've just been in South Africa this summer, and there was a political issue that developed there that was kind of interesting. There had been an invitation to Beyoncé, the bride of Jay-Z, to come to South Africa to perform and incidentally make a lot of money for doing so. And a number of the activists there were very unhappy with that. And they were saying, no, we don't want Beyoncé. And in African language, they said, Pansy Beyoncé, which means down with Beyoncé. And then they said, Viva, or up with Sahara. Now, I didn't know anything about Sahara, so I checked her out, and I've listened to her music, and I'm now going to introduce you to a song from Sahara, A Brand New Day, from her new album, all the way from South Africa.
Sacco and
little music in an African language to get us going today here on News Dissector Radio. Cat Waters in the studio. Would you introduce our first guest, if you will?
Called the People's Lawyer, the New York Times calls Colin Mayer a populist crusader and maverick lawyer. New York Times, October 15th, 2004. Mr. Mayer's biggest impact was when he was profiled by Mike Wallace, Morally Safer on CBS news program 60 Minutes. Mayer, then an elected independent town councilman in Princeton, New Jersey, went undercover and wore a wire to expose the rampant corruption and criminality epidemic to New Jersey and increasingly American politics. Mr. Mayer dedicates his law practice, writing, and electoral efforts to ending the tyranny of corporate power over American citizens. He has written in law journals opposing efforts by corporations to use the Bill of Rights, intended only for American citizens, to shield corporations from accountability and legal sanctions. Mr. Mayer worked on the Nike versus Caskey case in the United States Supreme Court that successfully prevented Nike from using the First Amendment to continue deceiving consumers about sweatshop labor used in Nike plants.
Wow. Now, just
and there's more.
One question, because Carl's mom is here, and she said she doesn't want to say anything, but is all this true? Absolutely,
and
she says,
more.
And much more. So we just wanted that confirmation from the source, so to speak, who also acknowledges to us that there is, in fact, a legitimate birth certificate for this man. Carl, you're a people's lawyer, and your most recent claim to fame, I believe, is this NDAA case. Tell us about it. What was it? What are the issues, and what role did you play?
Sure. Well, thanks, Danny, for having me on, and thanks for your longstanding activism on behalf of progressives and all Americans. It's an honor to be here. Thanks for having my mother here to kibitz, as it were. And thank you for that introduction, Catherine. I appreciate it.
Pleasure.
Well, why don't I just update your listeners on what's happening with the what's come to be known as the NDAA, but it was really called by Republican senators the Homeland Battlefield Bill, because essentially they believe that America should be turned into a battlefield. They believe that America is a battlefield, and as such, the military has dominion over that battlefield, and that's what we're fighting. And the most important thing for your listeners to know is that the fight is not over. There's been several articles in the press that have gotten the status of the case wrong.
Surprise! Go ahead.
Right. not here in the progressive press, but in the so-called mainstream media. This case was initiated back in January when you had some courageous plaintiffs who stepped forward, including Chris Hedges, who's frequently on the show. Considers it his one of his home away from homes. But in addition to Chris Hedges, there's Daniel Ellsberg, perhaps the most famous whistleblower in American history, who was involved in the Pentagon Papers litigation. And then a group of young activists. And what I've been delighted by as an attorney, it's been an honor to represent all these young people who are involved with Occupy Wall Street, and related groups and WikiLeaks, who are never been participating in politics before. They decided that enough was enough, and they had to do something about the ever encroaching corporate power and power of the state on behalf of the corporation. So,
last night in the debate that you missed, and I was forced to watch because I'm writing about it for Al Jazeera, but President Obama said, I spend every day worrying about the safety of the American people. Now, he didn't talk about the economic security of the American people. He talked about their safety. And that seemed to me to be a code word for a lot of efforts to really crack down on freedoms in our country in the name of, quote, safety, in the name of national security. Now, this NDAA bill seems to be in that ignoble tradition. Tell me about it. What was the situation you confronted when you took on this case?
Right. Well, the deal was that this is a bill that was signed into law in the dead of night on January 31st last year. While Americans were enjoying their New Year's Eve, President Obama was signing this bill.
This was December 31st,
2011, because you know, there's no news the next day. Everyone's hungover. And he didn't want people examining this bill. Because what this bill does, in a word, is it takes our freedom and it allows the U.S. military to detain people, including American civilians, American citizens, in military prisons. And the language of the bill is until the end of hostilities, which would mean forever, and without trial, and without an attorney. So essentially, it's militarizing the justice system. And the bill targets, and this is the language that's used, it targets people who are suspected of, quote, substantially supporting al-Qaeda, the Taliban, or, quote, associated forces, or other groups that are, quote, engaged in hostilities with the United States and its coalition partners. Okay? None of these words has any definition in the statute. It's totally amorphous. This is a license for the military to patrol our streets. And in fact, back when Obama was twisting himself into a pretzel and saying he was going to veto the NDAA, he was going to, and he was opposing the bill, he wrote a letter to the Congress in which he stated that we have a 200-year tradition in this country that the military does not police our streets. Dates back to at least the Civil War.
So what's your theory? I mean, was he sort of, quote, captured by the military somehow? Or do you think he was a real believer in this? He's so uptight about the possibility that there might be something that would jeopardize, quote, the safety of the American people. He's willing to do anything to, quote, protect them. And as we know, most of these protections don't protect.
Right. I mean, that's an excellent question, Dan. I think the key to this is Obama's himself a constitutional professor, former constitutional law professor. And he knows better. He knows this law is unconstitutional. But I think it's just politics. He doesn't want the Republicans to turn his right flank on national security. So he's running to the right of Rick Santorum on civil liberties issues in this campaign. Rick Santorum actually opposed the NDAA and the Homeland Battlefield Bill. And what he did is he went ahead and he signed this into law, knowing, after saying he would veto it, knowing it's unconstitutional because he has supported virtually every measure that erodes our civil liberties since he's been in office. He has created this doctrine of targeted assassinations of Americans, which is astounding to me because his attorney general has come out and said directly that the citizens of the United States don't have due process. They only have the due process. They have due process, but they don't have due process in the courts. They only have process that's given to them by the executive branch. So in other words, it's up to Obama to decide who lives and who dies when it comes to targeted assassinations, even if they're American citizens. So, again,
this is a bit of a, let's just, reinforce this point. This is a bit of a stretch in terms of American tradition up until this point to some degree, isn't it? I mean, doesn't this take things to a whole new level?
That's right. It's absolutely right. It's been gradually happening over the last 10 years under the Bush and Obama administrations. Since 9/11, we've seen the greatest assault on civil liberties in America since the McCarthy era. It started with the Patriot Act, which allows the government to go into people's into the libraries and view what people are reading and looking at in the libraries.
If I might just jump in here, an act, by the way, which many of the people who voted for it said they, quote, didn't have time to read. So we have members of the legislature, the legislative branch, the Congress of the United States, passing a law that they didn't read. And didn't know really the implications of because they didn't want to be perceived as being, quote, soft on terrorism or something like that, right? I mean,
yeah, that's exactly right. And the politicians of both parties have been falling all over each other for the last 10 years to beat their chests and try to be the most aggressive in fighting terrorism when what they're really doing is cutting back on American civil liberties. And there's no evidence that all of these measures are making the country safer.
And, I mean, isn't that whole, because I hear Obama say that all the time, oh, the people, it's all for the safety of the people. I mean, that's like a selling point. I mean, that's just to get the people to go along, when in reality, it's not for the safety of the people at all.
Right. Well, I think the most telling indictment of that position, that this is really for the safety of the people, was this fantastic series that the Washington Post did in 2010, the summer of 2010. A reporter named Dana Priest did an investigative report over several months called Top Secret Government. And that report showed that there are now 1,200 agencies within the United States government devoted to terrorism. On top of that, there are another 1,900 private contractors that are devoted to anti-terrorism. So it's now at the point where there are almost a million, there are 900 and some odd thousand people in Washington, D.C., who have security clearance in this, quote, war on terrorism. And in that study detailing how out of control this is in the government with the private contractors and the billions that is spent, they interviewed a general who was brought in with the task of trying to coordinate and make sense of all these agencies. He said, you couldn't do it. The general said, you can't keep track of all these different agencies and their conflicting priorities and what they're doing and trying to ferret out what Americans are doing. Well, this isn't making the population safe.
Well, this may actually be Mr. Obama's jobs bill because it's created a lot of jobs. And now, wasn't there just a report on the Department of Homeland Security, so-called fusion centers or some, centers that they've set up to fight terrorism that haven't found one terrorist yet and haven't done anything in this regard, and there's now questions about whether it should be funded?
Right, and they have like 30 of these centers around the country. They're throwing billions at this, and on top of all of this government spending and cash welfare to these private contractors that are bleeding the taxpayer, on top of this, they keep passing bill after bill that takes away our civil rights. Last year in America, there were 106 applications by government agencies for domestic use of drones. Okay, so you have the drones coming to
domestic here
in the United States. 106 applications that were filled out by various government entities, federal, state, and local. They were submitted to the FAA, requesting airspace for drone usage. Okay, so that comes after the whole warrantless wiretapping bill that was passed under Bush and which Obama has expanded, which allows the government to look at the phone records and private records of all Americans without a review of a court. We've been fighting that litigation in court since 2006, and actually we won a victory in the Ninth Circuit. We got the case against the government reinstated a while ago. So now the summit of all this, the worst of all this, is the NDAA, which now allows the military to come in and start policing our streets.
Now, what happens when you go into court and raise these issues? Take us through, the people's lawyer in the courts of justice or
right.
As you may remember, the famous comment by Lenny Bruce, who said, in the halls of justice, the only justice is in the halls. Now, tell me about what happens when you go right into court. The judge is there, and you make a motion or what?
Well, yes. What we did is we made a motion for an injunction to stop this law from taking effect on the grounds that it's unconstitutional. This law being, it's the NDAA, or otherwise known as the Homeland Battlefield Act, but it's we'll call it the law that allows the military to imprison U.S. citizens. So we made a motion before the judge to enjoin this law, to stop this law on the grounds that it violates our free speech rights under the First Amendment. It violates our due process rights because we're entitled as Americans to a trial by jury, and they want to take this away. So we made this motion. We made it back in March. And fortunately, there was a courageous federal district court judge named Judge Catherine Forrest. She's not a radical by any means. She's mainstream. She was a partner at a large corporate law firm named Cravath, Swain & Moore. But she looked at the evidence in this case. We held a trial down in the Southern District of New York. We brought our witnesses in. We allowed them to be cross-examined by the government. They made a compelling case, and the judge ruled on May 16th that she was going to enjoin as a preliminary matter the NDAA. So it was an enormous victory for the public. From May all the way until September, that injunction is in place, meaning that the government could not pick up U.S. citizens under this Homeland Battlefield bill.
But then...
The judge, after another series of hearings, made the injunction not just preliminary, but permanent. So she wrote an order which barred the government from using that law to put Americans in prisons.
The reaction of our government?
The reaction of our government was they went berserk. They went insane.
Apocalypse.
They worked late on a Friday night. They filed papers at 10:30 on a Friday night after she had filed her order. They worked over the weekend and then filed another pile of papers Monday morning, the following Monday morning, stating if the judge's order is allowed to stand, it will impair the security of the United States. The president will not have the ability to fight the war without this homeland battlefield bill.
Even though he says he'll never use it, even though he signed
even
it.
Even though he says he'll never use
it's
it.
Like, I mean,
right.
It's re-
even though he says he'll never use
and
it.
And then they're fighting like right. tooth and nail to have it like reinstated, even though he's never
going
to use it.
Insane. I guarantee you, there has never been a time at the Justice Department where they've worked late into Friday night and over
right.
the weekend.
For something that they're never going to use.
They've never done that to indict the Wall Street people responsible for the mortgage crisis. They've never done it. Yeah. They've never done it to go after corporate crime or securities violations or worker safety or any of the 100 other things that they could do. But they went nuts on this. So finally, they got the Second Circuit Court of Appeals, which is the appellate level that sits above Judge Forrest, to grant a stay pending an appeal. And there's been some confusion for that. I want to clarify for your listeners. A stay just means that they've lifted the injunction that Judge Forrest put in for the next 3 months while the appeal is heard. This appeal is going to be heard on an expedited basis, which is what we wanted, which that was somewhat of a victory for us. This case may go all the way to the Supreme Court. I don't know. We're going to fight it all the way. If people want to join in the fight, there's a website, stopndaa.org, or our website, carlmayer.com. People can get in touch, get in contact. I would liken it to a football game. We're in the second half. We won the first. We were ahead by probably a couple touchdowns after the first half because we won the preliminary injunction and we got a great record at trial. The record at trial was terrific. The testimony of Chris Hedges was terrific. The testimony of Birgitta Jonstadir was terrific. The testimony of these young activists was terrific. But now we go through the appeal process. And the Obama administration, we called the Obama administration not to appeal this, not to take a stand for civil liberties. But they wouldn't do that. Not only wouldn't they do that, but they went insane and filed all these emergency motions.
So doesn't this put you under a tremendous amount of pressure financially as well as in terms of your time? You're up against the Justice Department with kind of unlimited numbers of lawyers and money to spend. And you're an advocate for, you know, a bunch of, you know, OWS activists and you know people that they perceive as loudmouths, and you have to try to respond to all of this coming at you at once.
Right. Well, the more you fight, the more you get better at it. We've been doing this for a lot of years. It is an uphill battle all the time, but we've been very lucky. We've had a great response from people around the country. We've had a lawyer volunteered his time. He's a retired lawyer from California. His name is Robert Yaffe. He flew in for the hearings. He's volunteered his time. We have a great student at Cardozo Law School, Zach Liska, volunteered his time. We have a woman who's a paralegal out in Boulder, Colorado. Rita Agu flew in, volunteered her time, and we're now starting to get. We're now starting to get some people who are coming in as experienced attorneys who are volunteering their time and working on this project. But we need help.
I just wanted to say, I think it really shows the incompetence of the Obama administration. I mean, if they can't look out for the safety of the people without, you know, like putting the people in straitjackets, then he's pretty much an incompetent as a leader. I think it just shows that. It's like, oh, yeah, well, we're going to put you all in a rubber room for your safety. And
well, I think what it shows is that they're not properly targeting the so-called war on terrorism.
Now, we're also speaking to you in what looks like a rubber room. But let me ask you one little minor question that's been raised with me. Mm-hmm. In his testimony, Chris Hedges, and I wish Chris was here to talk about this, mentioned, you know, he said, well, I went to a bookstore, a kind of revolutionary communist bookstore to speak, and could this then be held against me as a sign of my being a terrorist? Now, the revolutionary communists came in and talked to me, and they said, this is putting us in danger because now the government might want to go after us. Is it, you know, is it possible that this whole nest of worms is going to get wormier, if you will, because, you know, the government is going to see other opportunities to go after people, to divide them and to harass them.
Well, that's absolutely right. There's no end to it. There's no end temporally in terms of time, because you can imprison people under this Homeland Battlefield bill until the end of hostilities, which could be forever. Who's to say when the end of, quote, hostilities is against terrorists? It's totally open-ended. There's no geographic limit to this.
Dick Cheney put it at 50 years, but at least 50 years.
Right. But okay. Well,
that might be a optimistic estimate on his, knowing him. You know, Darth Vader put it at 1,000 years, so I don't know.
But isn't that the whole point, again? Like, they're using terrorism as an excuse so that they can take the people's freedoms away.
Yes, we've seen a lot of that in American history. We saw that during the McCarthy era.
That seems obvious.
But you know what? But fortunately, during some periods of time, the courts have during certain periods of time, the courts have fought back and the people have fought back, and we're seeing more and more of that now. Judge Forrest was a courageous opinion, but this really goes back to there was a case decided shortly after the Civil War. It's a case called Ex Parte Milligan. And it involved a member of the Confederacy who wanted to overthrow some of the northern governments because he was a believer in slavery, and he felt that the northern governments were trying to dictate to the south. So he hatched a plan as a civilian to blow up the main government buildings in Indiana, Ohio, and Michigan. He was captured and put in a military prison. He was detained and put in a military prison before that plan could be executed. The court ruled in Ex Parte Milligan, and this is back in 1867, that even during the time of crisis, even during the Civil War, this man, because he's an American citizen, has the right to trial in a civil court with a jury of his peers. Doesn't matter that there's a war going on. So the court rejected the idea that the military can just go pick up citizens.
So we're still fighting this battle back to the Civil War, probably before the Civil War, and it's intensifying today. You're on the front lines, Carl, of this battle. I think everybody who believes in civil liberties, believes in the rights of citizens in this country, has to support you. You asked a moment ago, we need help, you said. How can people help you?
They can go to our website, either carlmayer.com or go to stopndaa.org. You can, send us funds. You volunteer your time. There's plenty of work to do, even if you're not a lawyer or a paralegal. We have tons of people who are volunteering. They help with the outreach efforts and the press efforts and getting, discussing with plaintiffs. So there's a role for everyone, but, we need as much help as we can get.
Well, there's a challenge for anyone listening to this program, all four of you. It's time really to stand up and to stand up with Carl and his team and all of the people who brought this lawsuit, which is so important for the future of our country. You didn't hear it mentioned, of course, in the debate, last night. You didn't hear it really reported properly in a lot of the media, but it's a fight that is going on right now. Carl Mayer is one of the people leading that fight. No doubt at risk himself, potentially, of being found as somehow helping the great terror conspiracy of the world, and what have you. But he's here with us today. Thank you so much for coming in and talking to us about this case. Please get in touch with him if you can. The website, again, is carlmayer.com or NDAA.
StopNDAA.org.
StopNDAA.org. There it is. Write that down and check that out. Now we go back to another little musical break to hear Sahara once again from South Africa, this great voice, this wonderful singer.
Only God knows how. countries in the entire planet that are more unequal than the United States in the distribution of our wealth.
This is corrupt!
Bankers, corporations throw the country into the gutter like dice. And whatever comes up, they win. Politicians are paid off to keep the game running. There's just no way you're going to be competitive in a rigged game. Some of the best people we have will never get a shot.
This is a movement moment. Here we're back with Danny Schechter, your news dissector. That's me here on Progressive Radio Network with Cat Waters. Our guest coming up right now, the People's Bishop, George Packard, is with us. He's the Bishop of the Episcopal Church, RET, I guess retired, who is still in action, if you will, including being arrested in Occupy Wall Street activities. We've just heard a song by Polarity One called Occupy, and an important song at that. And staying with us is Carl Meyer and his mom for a few more minutes in this session. How are you, George? Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Danny. Can you hear me okay, by
yeah,
the way?
Yeah, I can.
Great. And, hi, Kat. How are you?
Hi, George.
Good. Before we go to you, we have one unresolved piece of business from our last segment. Mom here feels strongly that we did not adequately define NDAA, and she's going to do it for us now. Please.
Just to explain what the letters stand for, National Defense Authorization Act, NDAA.
There you go.
For the three people who didn't know it.
Right. So it's a good. Is it a good Scrabble word? I don't know. But thank you so much. George, why are you such a troublemaker?
Boy, I got to tell you, my daughters call me regularly, particularly after I get out of jail, and they ask me the same question. It sounds like a kind of a limp answer to this, Danny, but I find myself in situations that seem to just beg for some kind of action. It started, and I'll make this brief. I started when I was just bringing bottles of water down to the Occupy encampment in Sakati back in October, and a cop wouldn't let me do it. He had detained me, had me up against the car. I had my collar on and everything, and I took up my federal, I was a bishop of the armed forces for the Episcopal Church, so I got all this gingerbread and eyewash to tell you people that, you know, I'm a really good guy, and I worked at the Pentagon, and I'm on your side, and so on. I worked at 9/11. He wouldn't hear anything of it. And so I, with my tail between my legs, I drove back up to Westchester, crept around the corner, put the water on the sidewalk, and called Benedict, my contact at the kitchen working group, and he picked it up. But I'm driving back, Danny, and I'm thinking to myself, there's really something going wrong with our country. I was just bringing water to some young people who were demonstrating. I couldn't sleep that night. I thought to myself, there's really something really, really wrong with the way we're proceeding, the way that we're encountering the culture and how we're expressing our civil rights. And so that set the tone for successive arrests and confrontations.
I mean, you climbed over the wall. I was right there down at 6th Avenue when Occupy was, you know, wanting to occupy this land owned by your own church. Your own church, not your personal church, but the Episcopal Church, the Trinity Church.
Yeah.
And you challenged the police and were arrested there. And it seems like, this has... Not only did your action inspire so many people, but it also defied the New York City Police Department. And so they probably have a nice, big, fat surveillance picture of you up in the precinct right now.
I guess so. You know, when you get inside, and Kat will tell you this, when you get inside the, you pass through that membrane and you go into One Police Plaza, the cops, who are these faceless characters who are humorless and who really are arrest because they've got quotas to fulfill, they become very human, and they tell you about their families, and they talk about how sympathetic they are with the movement, and I mean, it's, it, and I, it just, you get the impression that we're all kind of trapped in the same kind of system that doesn't let us express ourselves and talk to each other. I mean, at this last anniversary protest, the cops had us so corralled and dead-ended, we couldn't turn around, you couldn't move, so you had to... I was talking to Captain Purcell, an old friend of mine there. I said, he said, Father, you got to move your group here. We had about 500 people behind me. I said, well, we're here to demonstrate and so on and so forth. He said, you have to move. He said, you're impeding the access to the financial district. I said, well, that's what we want to do. So,
you know, you talked a second ago about meeting others, and in the studio with us is Carl Meyer, who's been called the people's lawyer, in part for his legal action against the NDAA, which was just defined for you a few moments ago by his mom, the National Defense Authorization Act. I even remember it now. And on top of that, you know, you're the people's bishop in a sense. So, you know, I don't know what I am. I'm sort of trying to be the people's news dissector, if you will. But one of the things that I think seems to be in common is he's fighting against a law or a legislation that would suppress people's rights, and you're out there in the streets seeing that suppression taking place, actually against the law, against, you know, common sense.
Well, I'm glad you intuit those connections, because I think that's exactly right. As I was eavesdropping on the interview before I came on the air with you, this NDAA is so scandalous that you can get snapped up off the street and never be heard from again. No habeas corpus, no nothing. And it's as if some sort of faceless definition of order has been given to us. We have no say-so. We elect these officials who go down into Washington, and they're this representative government that we never hear from again. If you're a lobbyist, you've got, as Lawrence Lessig talks about, you've got more say-so in our government than we do. So we have no personal, as Carney Ross wrote in this book, that Leaderless Revolution book, great book, he said we have no personal agency anymore. It's really true. We have no say. There's, and we have no, from my perspective as a clergyman, people have lost their own personal individual dignity, no human dignity. It's just eroded. It's painful to watch.
Well, Carl, comment if you will, because you're doing it. You're standing up every day in a very difficult terrain in a court of law with all of these judges and prosecutors and federal government people who wish you weren't there and wish you didn't exist. And here we have the same thing seems to be true of Bishop, the bishop here, who, you know, who's challenging his own church, if you will.
Yeah. Well, again, my regards to Bishop Packer, and thank you for all the work you've done with Occupy Wall Street.
Thank you.
You know, one of our clients in this case is a woman named Kai Wargala, who was one of the founders of Occupy London.
Yes.
And I don't know if Bishop Packard knows Kai.
Yeah, I was in the courtroom with Chris Hedges and Cornell West when she testified.
Oh, yes, right. I think we shook hands briefly.
Absolutely.
That day.
I'm a great fan of yours.
So, well, likewise, it's mutual, Bishop. And, you know, the story of Kai is... again, a young activist, she's from Germany, moved to London, started Occupy Wall Street. She lives, I think, on a barge in the middle of the Thames River.
Yeah.
Never been involved in politics before. Weeks after starting Occupy London, a bulletin comes out from the London police listing Occupy London as a terrorist organization right next to Al-Qaeda. And this is where it's all going. This is where it's heading. And that's why what we're doing in the courtroom... compliments. I mean, what the bishop is doing and what his fellow occupiers are doing is much more important out on the streets. But we have to fight in both arenas, because you know, they're trying to lawfully characterize anyone who dissents as a terrorist, and that has to stop.
Yes,
but
yes.
They keep pushing and overstepping the definition of terrorist. So now it's just, you know, standing up for your rights is considered terrorism. I mean, they just kind of keep, stretching and stretching, you know, the definition, you know, more and more, and stepping over your boundaries. I mean, it's crazy.
Right. That's exactly what's going on. And you see the erosion in the language. They add all these phrases like domestic terrorist, environmental terrorist, eco-terrorist. So it's any time anyone is standing up for a principle or speaking out, they're labeled terrorist.
Well, when I was active in the anti-apartheid movement, South African government called me and many others a media terrorist, to put it in the proper Afrikaans accent, you know.
Yes.
And so media terrorism was, in their view, is more insidious than real terrorism and what have you. And, of course, among the people who stood up against that was one of your fellow churchmen and brothers in Christ, if you will, whatever. I don't know.
Desmond Tutu.
Desmond Tutu is coming to New York this weekend to be part of the Brussels Tribunal on Palestine. I was with Bishop Tutu recently in South Africa, and of course, he is waging a battle, you know, not only against apartheid in the past in South Africa, but for social justice there and apartheid in Israel. So he's a, you know, a stand-up person. All three of you are. I'm really happy that you've joined us on the show. I hope that people will respect and support your work. Unfortunately, we have another appointment we made last week with an investigative reporter in St. Louis who's investigating a Cold War program that we want to tell you about.
Okay.
So we're going to have to cut it short right now. But how do people reach you, Bishop Packard?
Well, I have a blog, and they connect with me that way. Occupied Bishop, O-C-C-U-P-I-E-D, Bishop. And they can post anything they want to. They can tell me to go to hell, or they can engage in conversation with me. I'd love to talk to them. And I just think we're up against, somehow, a threatened culture starts putting candles around the high order of high altar of society that has order as its main foci, and it's disturbing because all kinds of things get set aside: civil liberties, free speech, freedom of assembly, all kinds of things.
Well, thank you again, and the three of you, and there I'm including your mom, Carl, are extremely articulate, and I'm really glad that you came on the program, and I hope we can have you back and get into some of this in more detail, because it's obviously our future here that we're talking about. Thank you so much. We're going to be going to St. Louis now.
Thank you, Dan.
Thanks, Steve.
And
thank you, George.
Speaking
thank
with
you,
Dr. Martino Taylor in St. Louis. Do we have Dr. Taylor on the line? Were we able to reach that Dr. Taylor? Hello? All right, well, we don't have her quite yet, so hopefully we will get her.
Maybe George can stay on.
Yeah, maybe you can. George, are you still there?
Because it dovetails with what you were saying about
apartheid. Hang out with us because we're having a guest issue here.
Well, guest issues, I understand guest issues, believe me.
No, it's my own fault. I mean,
No. By the way, your investigative mind here is, and bringing these two strands together is very helpful. The thing that really alarms me is this. I'm starting to talk about the prime value in the society seems to be order, with a capital O, with nothing else. And maybe this is the post 9/11 mindset, but it is very, very scary, because now, and Kat will affirm this, that when the cops used to announce before they make an arrest on the streets in New York City, now they don't do that. They just they chase and grab, and they understand the sociology of Occupy. The sociology is to be connect with your friends, back each other up, sit down, be nonviolent. But now with this street tactic of not announcing before they arrest, they could just run into in the middle of a demonstration of protesters and grab somebody.
Well, we saw that in action, Kat and myself, on the anniversary of Occupy here in New York, and I'm sure we'll see more of it. You see there are more lawsuits, the 2004 cases in New York. They were found to be illegal arrests. I'm sure these will be found to be illegal also. But in the meantime, people are suffering, and the society is not being given, is not allowing people to express themselves. Freedom of speech and freedom of expression
is at
question.
That's just it. I mean, it's so blatant. I mean, the exact thing that the people are complaining about is right there in the actions of you know, the so-called authority that has absolutely no regard and no respect for the average person.
Absolutely. Please indulge me because I'm the one that sort of screwed this up.
Did you find your guest?
I did. And so we have to go to St. Louis. Martino Taylor in St. Louis, our apologies for getting to you so late. We've been engrossed in a discussion here on the Progressive Radio Network and somehow missed this connection, but we're happy that you're there. Tell us a little bit about your research, Dr. Taylor, and what you actually have discovered in St. Louis and why we should care about it.
Well, it's a pleasure to be with you. My research looked into a group of people who had a very coordinated group of men who had worked on the Manhattan Project, and they were part of a larger national goal to test radiological weapons, to test and develop radiological weapons. And they would do this through a number of different ways, injection, ingestion, and inhalation. And there's strong lines of evidence that people in minority neighborhoods in the St. Louis area were subjected to Army studies that seemed to be related to this radiological weapons testing project without their knowledge or consent.
So we're talking now here about radiological weapons. We're talking about people in minority communities not knowing what they were dealing with here. We're talking about Cold War experiments that you began to investigate. How did you come to investigate this and why?
Well, I had been approached by a colleague at work who came to me, and she told me this story about how she had been she was actually battling breast cancer at the time, and she told me that when she was a child that she was on the playground at school and that she had been sprayed with something by the government, she believed, and she wanted to know if I knew anything about it, and I didn't. But a week later, a neighbor came to me and told me the same story, that she had been on the playground at school as a young child and that the Army had sprayed her with something, and she felt like a brain tumor that she had had 10 years before was connected to it, and could I find out something about it for her?
Wow. So this is a really pretty explosive. Apparently, your senators in Missouri have asked the Army about it. Do we know anything more now than we knew when you first revealed this?
We know nothing more. Senator McCaskill and Senator Blunt and Congressman Clay have all called for investigations. I think it should include a public hearing because we haven't heard from the people who were targeted, input of citizens who were there. And a lot of those people came to the colloquium where I presented my findings, and they clearly wanted to be heard.
Now, this is, like, pretty shocking, but apparently pretty common. You know, we keep hearing about, you know, various, quote, experiments that took place years ago suddenly popping up, you know, the Tuskegee experiments, on black, military people and prisoners, all sorts of vulnerable populations being used without their knowledge, without their consent, with very dangerous investigations. And you seem to have stumbled on one. Now, have you written about this? Is there a way that people who are listening in can check out more and get more information from you?
Yeah, I have. I actually did this project for my doctoral dissertation, and I've made sure that is online. I believe that as much research as possible should be available free of charge to anyone who can access it. And so I have made sure that full dissertation is available free to anyone who wants to access it. It's available through a company called ProQuest, to regularly process master's theses and dissertations.
So you don't have the URL, but it's ProQuest, is that it?
Yes, it's ProQuest. I can actually send that to you if you have a...
We'll certainly would like you to, and we'll remind people next week about how to reach out to this. But it seems like your research started out as sort of an academic research, has morphed into something much more serious and much bigger, with two U.S. senators and a congressman calling for information from the military. So far, they haven't gotten that information, but they want details of potential health impacts, the possibility of a radioactive component in a Cold War era particulate dispersal experiment in St. Louis. And I thought this was an important story when I read about it, and I wanted to share it with our listeners, because I think it's gutsy of you to raise these questions, because I'm sure there are a lot of people who would like to bury this whole history.
I'm sure that's true. And you brought up a couple points. The first one, you mentioned the Tuskegee syphilis study. That was done by the United States Public Health Service. They conducted that study over decades. At the same time that the United States Public Health Service was conducting that study in Tuskegee with syphilis, they were doing this study in St. Louis. It was the same agency that was doing part of this study here. Now, the study was done in 1953 and 1954, and then the Army returned again in 1963 to 1965 with the Public Health Service, and then they did it in tandem. So the Public Health Service was involved in both of those studies, not just the Tuskegee study, but also this study in St. Louis.
Was any of this connected with the Igloo Pruitt housing project there that's since been blown up?
Yeah, Pruitt-Igoe. Right, the Pruitt-Igoe housing complex was really the target area of, I mean, that really was the area that they most targeted in this study. And, you know, when I looked at the census, I pulled apart by census tract to see who lived in these areas and what were the boundaries exactly. And then when I did an aerial photo of the time, of that era, of that year, and I laid it over a street map, I could see the Pruitt-Igoe housing complex just like a beacon in the landscape. It was very clearly right there in that area. One of the census tracts that was most targeted was 79% persons of color. 16,000 people were directly targeted in just the first part of this study. And in the second part of the study, over a ton of this finely milled powder that was sprayed morning, noon, and night from street level and rooftops, over a ton of this material was sprayed in the air.
Wow. Well, we don't have any more time to deal with this, but if you give us more specifics on how people can find out about it, we'll report it next week. Thank you so much for your research and for your work. Of course, that housing project was subsequently blown up, in part because it was an example, supposedly, of public housing that wasn't working. But maybe it was also to cover something else up that we're just finding out about now. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm sorry we were a little late in getting to you, but I think everything you said is something that everybody here will remember. Thank you again. I'm Danny Schechter. I'm your news dissector. If you want to reach me, you can write to dissector@mediachannel.org. I blog every week at newsdissector.net. I have articles up on Al Jazeera, on Press TV, and many other websites, op-ed news, including the website of PRN.fm. If you're interested in any of my work and any of my articles, please, check them out and write to me. Also, you can hear this program in the archives at PRN.fm. Kat, thanks so much for organizing this program, in part with people like Carl Meyer and the Bishop, who are phenomenal guests.
Yeah, they made a really good pair here on the show today.
I'm really excited to be able to bring this to you. We'll be going out with a song that's from my film In Debt We Trust back in the 2006, still relevant, unfortunately, still timely, still important. Sing along.
To chase and to walk home.